Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, and welcome to our first Smart Talk road trip since February of 2020. As part of WITF's 9/11 20 Years Later project, we're broadcasting today from the State Museum of Pennsylvania. A new exhibit called Witness to History has opened at the State Museum to remember 9/11. Specifically, United Flight 93 that crashed into a field in Somerset County as hero passengers wrestled with hijackers to gain control of the plane. The exhibit includes notes taken by former Pennsylvania State Police Commissioner Colonel Paul Ivanko, who was on the scene of the crash that day with former Governor Tom Ridge. Former Commissioner Ivanko is with us today. Colonel, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
20 years. A lot has happened in 20 years, but take me back to that beautiful day. That's what everyone talks about, was how gorgeous that Tuesday morning was. But take me back to September 11th, 2001 for you as Commissioner of the Pennsylvania State Police.
Well, that day started the same as any other day. I was in the barracks very early, as I normally am, and I would get caught up on routine type things. And then I had gone down to a off-site location to work on a confidential matter that I was involved in. And while I was at that off-site location by myself, I had a call from my confidential executive secretary saying, you better turn one of the TVs on. I turned it on, and the first plane had just crashed. I was maybe 60 to 90 seconds away from the Pennsylvania Emergency Management Agency and the command post there. I threw everything into a briefcase, and within another 60 seconds, I was operational at the command center cell for the Pennsylvania State Police. I was in there by myself. I was the first person to arrive because everybody goes to the Pima Operations Center in an emergency like that.
Let me interrupt for just 1 second. Just that was before the second plane crashed into the World Trade Center and Pennsylvania was not involved. That's typical when there is some kind of incident like that across the country, or maybe because it was in close proximity, New York?
I can tell you that it's not typical. I just had a sense that there's something bigger going on here. I don't know whether it was the environment at the time or what it was, but I thought there was something else going on, and I could be at the emergency operations center where I thought that I might belong.
An instinct.
It was an instinct. One of the things as troopers that you learn is you pay attention to your instinct. If something tells you that it's wrong, you better pay attention to it. And that goes to the extent of doing undercover work, working with people that you need to be really careful with, and follow what your instinct has to say. That's what my instinct had to say. And I walked inside. I got a cell up and running. Every agency has a cell, a separate place to work, but they're all together. And there's banks of huge monitors there that you can watch. You can talk to everybody, and everything's cohesive, and you can exchange information. Well, as I'm getting the cell set up by myself now, all of a sudden I could see on the TV that the second plane had crashed into the World Trade Center. With that, I made calls to Lieutenant Colonel Tom Corey, who was the Deputy Commissioner of Operations for the State Police, to get a command post set up at State Police Headquarters, get a hold of the Southeast Pennsylvania troopers, have as many of them head. Well, we hadn't gotten them. I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit. In any event, we ended up with the with Flight 93 watching Flight 93 on the monitors, on the radar monitors, and watching it as it moved around, as it moved over into the next state, as it came back, as it started to head south. And by that time, we had troopers heading to the southeast part of, southwest part of Pennsylvania, because you knew something was wrong. Something was going to happen there. And as it was, we watched as that plane left the radar screen. And by that time, we had a helicopter on the way to that area just in case something did happen.
So you actually were able to watch on radar Flight 93 after it crossed the Ohio-Pennsylvania border, or before it came in
as
to
it
the
came,
state?
As it came back into Pennsylvania, you could watch it. So we knew something was going to happen.
Did anyone give you a heads up ahead of time, like, hey, you may want to watch this flight, because, I mean, like air traffic control or anything?
There was a lot of talk going on at that time. There was speculation that there might be 12 planes up there. So, yeah, there was a lot of conversation going on. I can't recall exactly what they were now, but there was a lot of conversation as to what, as to things going on. In any event, I watched as that plane left the radar screen, and we knew at that time, obviously, there's something wrong.
Before we get to Flight 93, at first you said southeast and
southwest.
Right, but I was curious when you said that, because of Philadelphia and tall buildings, was that something that was being discussed, like, okay, what could be potential targets here in Pennsylvania?
You raise a really interesting dilemma that we face. There were things that were going on that would lead one to believe that something somewhere is going on. One of which is airplanes, among other things. So we had put together a list of significant targets that might be involved in, not that we hadn't knew anything, that might be involved in a catastrophic event. So I had paperwork on, for example, nuclear power plants. Earlier, Governor Ridge had instructed me, wanted to know the status of the nuclear power plants and the security of the nuclear power plants. That was a little bit before this now. And he wanted to know it to the extent that he said, I want you to go there. I want you to go to each of the nuclear power plants. I want you to do an assessment, and you tell me whether you think they're secure or whether you don't. So that took a little bit of time. That was earlier, okay? My assessment was that those nuclear power plants, and he was really focused on those, were safe. There were some concerns, but nothing major with the nuclear power plants. But with that out of the way, I had list of every major pharmaceutical company, the big ones, and there are some big ones in Pennsylvania, one in particular, every major power installation, anything at all that would sustain a society, I had a list of, I had contacts for, I knew where we would have to go if an incident occurred in any one of those, and the whole teams that we had together as well. So we got into that as well.
So when you did see United Flight 93 disappear from the radar screen, what next? What happened?
Lieutenant Colonel Corey was running the actual operations. I talked to him. I said, we need to get people out there, troopers out there, to see what's going on. He took it upon himself to get a ship or a helicopter out there to see if we could see anything from the air. And that's when we knew, and there was other conversations from one of the terminals, one of the air terminals, that there was a plane that had gone down. Tom confirmed that, our aircraft confirmed it, and that's what initiated all those troopers starting to head to the southwest.
When did you have your first contact with Governor Ridge, and when was decided that you would accompany Governor Ridge to the site itself?
That started a little bit earlier. The governor was in another part of the state, and I had to track him down, which I'm in contact with him all the time anyway. We had some problems because by that time, the air traffic controllers took everybody out of the air. Nobody could fly. So the governor was out of town. How do you get him back to Pennsylvania? So we had to work with the people that we work with to get authorization that he could be in the air. We flew him by helicopter from where he was to Harrisburg, and that's where we ended up having a press conference and then flying out in a Chinook to the scene.
So the governor gets off the Chinook, you get off the Chinook. What do you see?
There wasn't a whole lot to see. I had seen a photograph that our helicopter had taken. I knew what it looked like. He didn't. And the thing that he asked me was, where is it? I said, it's right now that we're on the ground now. I said, it's right there. It's right in front of you. And he said, I don't see it. Well, because it was embedded in the ground to a depth of 50 feet. That's why you couldn't see it. And it had been practically pulverized. So that was our introduction to the actual scene.
How many people were there? What was the scene like at that time? With the exhibit, you will see video that the governor held a press conference. It seemed like there were maybe 100 people around. But what was everyone doing, the state police in particular?
Well, the instructions to the Pennsylvania State Police were get as many troopers there as you can. So 50 troopers show up from one part of the state, another 50 show up, another 75 show up, another 25 show up, until we have hundreds of troopers there. And their job was to secure that scene as a evidence site. Nobody goes in, nobody goes out, unless it's authorized by one of the commanders. That led into setting up, having the FBI come out, the FAA come out, and everybody else. So it got to be a matter of trying to contain, control, and direct all of the people that were coming, the EMS people, the Salvation Army people, everybody that comes. And there were literally, it was a matter of controlling people so that we didn't contaminate the scene and that we kept, number one, that we kept the sanctity of the scene, because it's obvious everybody, there wasn't anybody there.
How do you keep from getting emotionally involved when you see something like that?
Well, first of all, I'm glad that you asked the question, because troopers deal with this stuff every day. We deal with horrendous death investigations, suicides, murders, accidental deaths, all kinds of bizarre and emotionally draining type incidents. We are trained, for instance, with me, I forget how many years I had on at the time, a lot. And we are trained to respond to these incidents, I don't want to say objectively, but respond in such a way that you don't invest your emotional energy into the scene and the devastation of a scene, but that you focus on what you are seeing, how it relates one to another, And you're trained to do that. And the more you do it, I don't want to say the easier it gets, but in fact, it becomes a little more, you become accustomed to these types of incidents and scenes, and it's a little less emotionally involved, but it's still, you're still emotionally involved in it, believe me. And you stay emotionally involved in it. That's why part of our state police program is that we have troopers who are trained as emotional support troopers, members assistance programs. If somebody is, for example, we had troopers there at the scene who were having deaths in the family. We had troopers there that were that were sick. There's one trooper, he's on his way in a shift change, and he comes across somebody that's not breathing. He's doing CPR. Another trooper's doing this. And all that is melding together. But the key to answer your question is that you take a deep breath, you take an emotional breath, and you focus on what your job is. And that's the safety and the integrity of the scene in this case.
I bring that up because part of this exhibit, Witness to History exhibit at the State Museum, includes your notes from that day. And one of the striking characteristics is how unemotional, I should say, that those notes are. And you can learn a lot from when you see this exhibit from the notes that you were taking. What were you looking to do with those notes?
You know, I can't tell you that I thought that X, Y, and Z. I intuitively knew that this was bigger than us and that it was going to get bigger. And number one was to document what I'm seeing so that whatever it is that I'm seeing, sounds a little redundant there, but whatever I'm seeing, I can relate it to another thing or another thing and put it all together at the end. So I was trying to document for our investigative needs and our any other needs that we might have.
History. You were thinking of history.
If we get down to it, that's what I was thinking of. Mm. I was thinking that we have to document, you know, there were things going on in the world, and I could cite case after case after case, major cases that were going on that, you know, you could think, man, I wonder what the next thing's going to be. I wonder what that's going to lead to. You know, those things are popping up in your mind. And if I would say that I wasn't thinking about those, it wouldn't be right. It wouldn't be true because I was. There were just so many things going on, and I was thinking about some of those things, even though I was trying to keep the emotion out of it. You have to keep the emotional part out of it and focus on what you're seeing, what you're hearing, and what you're understanding.
We have a question from a listener, a member of our audience today. Can you describe the means of communications used by the local EMS and volunteer amateur radio operators to coordinate on-site response?
I can't tell you. They were using, I forget the radios, ham radios, and that was working out good for that group of people, but you had to have one if you were going to communicate that way. So that's what they were using. We were using our regular mobile radios, and that communications was a big deal because so many different agencies were trying to operate on so many different frequencies that you had to really be careful there.
Also joining us is State Archivist David Carmichael, Mr. Carmichael is instrumental in putting the Witness to History exhibit together. David, first of all, thank you. It's good to see you again in person for the first time in a long time. But tell us how this exhibit came to be.
Well, it started with Colonel Ivanko donating these documents to us. When he retired from state government, many of his records came to the state archives anyway, but he took many of his personal papers with him. But he has a wonderful eye for history. And so he contacted us in 2015, I think, and donated to us these records along with many records around the history of state police. And it's interesting to me as I look at these notes. I think they are just fantastic archival documents. He wasn't thinking of history in one sense as he was writing these notes. He was doing a job. And so there's no ulterior motive in these notes. He's not trying to paint himself a certain way. He's just doing his job, which makes them very fresh, very objective. And I think I mentioned to you that if you just read the words, they're very cool and calm and factual. He's taking in facts. He's making decisions. He's recording those decisions. But if you see the actual notes, you see how the pen moves across the page. You see the underlining, the circling, the arrows, and you get the sense of the emotion that he is holding back with great effort, I think. I urge people to come and see the notes. You can even see the pressure of the pen on the paper. It's just a fantastic document that shows the objective professionalism that was going on, plus the emotion that was being held in check.
As a historian, what stuck out to you with what Colonel Ivanko brought to the State Museum, to the archives?
I think the fact that this is such an important event nationally, and these records were made right at the time of the event. We're always looking for records that are close to the event, and they were made by a person who had the competence and the expertise to understand what was going on to the extent that anyone could. And so the notes just capture in a way that I think almost nothing else can what was happening that day. We're actually seeing his mind at work on this page. And to me, the other thing I see here, we all know that there was a pre-9/11 mindset and there was a post-9/11 set. As I read through these notes, I see the colonel's mind shifting from pre-9/11 to post-9/11. And at the beginning of the notes, there are certain things he says that by the end of the notes, he wouldn't be saying, I think.
Like what?
Well, there's one in particular, and I've heard you talk about sending patrol cars to the power plants and things like that. But the first note that he wrote there early was, double the troopers at power plants starting tomorrow. Now, you didn't wait till tomorrow, because within probably a few minutes, it was evident, no, we can't wait till tomorrow. But that statement, to me, is a pre-9/11 mindset. Within a few minutes or hours, you could not have written it that way.
Right.
And so I see this document as it's almost like a film. It's recording your mind at work as it shifts from one set of assumptions to a brand new set of assumptions.
The exhibit has other media as well, video that was shot by Commonwealth Media Services. But the written word seems to have more of an impact, especially with what you just described, David. I mean, as you said, you could see how things changed from that pre-9/11 to post-9/11. So just for logistical purposes, for those listening, the exhibit is at the State Museum of Pennsylvania, how long is it here?
I have to turn to Beth for that.
January 2nd,
she says. All right. I want to thank both of you. Go ahead. We're going to say,
Colonel.
Could
I just say a few more words? As I recollect some of these things, some of them may flip around a little bit. I have to be very careful and focus on what I'm saying and making sure that they are accurate. But, you know, When did you see this and when did you see that? Things like that, you know, they may have been mixed up a little bit. I don't think so. But I also wanted to say that Governor Ridge played such a significant role in this whole situation. And I would ask, because of his what happened and he got sick and so forth and so on, he hasn't been able to be with us for a long while. And I would appreciate if, for Governor Ridge and for Mrs. Ridge, that we take just a moment to remember him and say our prayer, whatever we want to do, for just 60, not even 60 seconds, and just remember him, because he was the one that held this all together. He's the one that gave the overall directions, and his directions were very clear. he said to me, you know, as we're, as all this is unfolding, and it's unfolding fast and furious, here's his saying, you know what to do. Go out and do it. That was the extent of his directions. You know, he had that much faith in us. But if we could just take a minute.
Unfortunately, I can't do that on live radio, but I think that we can.
In our minds,
there we
please.
Go.
Okay, thank you very much for giving me the latitude.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk, and it is a Smart Talk road trip, our first road trip since February of 2020 with a live audience. And the live audience seems to just bring some more energy to the program. I want to mention that today's Smart Talk road trip live remote broadcast is supported by Fort Pitt Capital Group. And I want to thank Fort Pitt Capital Group for their support. Now, you're hearing the memories of many people, public officials, and media this week, as the 20th anniversary of 9/11 comes up this Saturday. But WITF's multimedia news director Tim Lambert has a unique perspective. Flight 93 crashed on land owned by Tim and his family. Tim has visited the crash site, written and produced programs focusing on the tragedy, and met with family members of the passengers many times over the past 20 years. This week, Tim and NPR Scott Detrow, a former WITF journalist himself, produced an hour-long documentary podcast called Sacred Ground. You must listen to Sacred Ground. We'll hear a little clip of it during this segment of our program today, but it will be broadcast on WITF 89.5 and 93.3 tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. Tim, thanks for joining us today.
Pleasure to be here.
Before we talk about Sacred Ground, just want to go back 20 years. And this is part of the podcast itself. You tell the story, but I think it's something that I call it fate. When you see a plane crash in western Pennsylvania, what are the chances that you look at it and think, huh, that's on our land? Tell us how you found out about Flight 93. We've talked about this many times over the years, but I only realized this year with hearing the podcast that you didn't know about it for a few hours.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So I, like every other journalist, as soon as I saw what was happening in New York, I had to get into work. Regardless of how Pennsylvania was going to be impacted, we, you know, are in close proximity to New York. So I just was heading in, and I lived in Gettysburg at the time, and I was only part-time at WITF. I literally was starting my third week as this part-time, all things considered, host.
He was well-paid, though.
Yeah. That's another topic. So I was driving, and I was on Route 15, and I remember probably around Dillsburg in York County, and I heard on the radio in Morning Edition that a plane had gone down near Shanksville, Somerset County. And it occurred to me that, oh, my dad grew up there. I hadn't been back there in a long time, but he might know somebody I can call, and maybe he can fill me in on who I can talk to and find out what's really going on. Then later in the afternoon, it was around 4:30, I'm in the chaos of the newsroom. I looked up at the television, and there was a national reporter standing at the intersection of the Lambertsville-Shanksville Road. And I sort of stared at the screen, and I thought, oh, we own land really close to Lambertsville, and that intersection is not far from Lambertsville. So everybody at the time, it was a reclaimed strip mine. And just to be clear, I'm one of several landowners that were part of this. So I covered a prayer vigil that night, drove home back to Gettysburg. It was about 1:30 in the morning, and, you know, we didn't have voicemail. It was an answering machine, so my answering machine's blinking. And I hit play, and it was my dad. And my dad always forgets that I'm a journalist. So he's like, I don't know if you saw the video of the crash site near Shanksville. And I'm like, oh, here we go. And then he said, I've been calling people. I've been talking to people. I've been studying that. He goes, those are our trees. And, I stared at the machine like, what did he just say? So I called him up, and he was insistent that was our property, where the 10 yards from the crater where those charred trees were, that was the start of our property line. So I called him, and he explained why, and I wasn't quite convinced. And he said, what do we do now? And I said, well, they're a little busy. they're going to find us when they need us. And that was about 3 weeks later when they confirmed that our land was part of the crash site.
When did you actually... Oh, by the way, when you said Lambertsville Road, I mean, I've seen the roads. Is that your family?
Yes.
Okay, I figured that. I mean, that would be too much of a coincidence.
a lot of Lamberts in Shanksville area.
But so when did you actually get to visit the site then?
It was probably the first weekend in October. So I had received a phone call from the Somerset County Coroner, Wallace Miller, a couple of days before that. And he's, Mr. Lambert, I want to confirm that your property is considered an essential part of the crash site. And so it ran through my mind immediately, like, I'm probably going to be working with this guy moving forward, so I want to be upfront and transparent. So I said, okay, well, I just want to let you know I'm a journalist. And anybody who's ever met Wally or talked to Wally, and we became great friends. He was in my wedding and a few years later, but, you know, he said, what are you going to do, report on yourself? And I was, I don't know. This is sort of new to me. I'm not sure what to do. So I told him I wanted to record our conversation, bring a camera, and, you know, because the site had been sealed off. The public hadn't seen anything other than that looping video and the photos of the crater. And he said, you can do what you want. It's your land. I'm not going to stop you. And that was the beginning of a beautiful relationship with Wally. But, yeah, so we went out that October, and we visited the site for the first time. And, you know, we got out of the car after we got through the security gate, and we smelled the jet fuel immediately, 3 weeks after the crash. So that immediately sort of stopped us in our tracks. And then Wally was explaining what happened. And as the plane came in, it sort of went over on itself and was upside down and straight down into the ground. And then the first class section in the cockpit broke off and blew into the tree line there. So that burned out tree absorbed that blast and that explosion. And then the rest of the plane telescoped on itself and just pulverized, you know, deteriorated. So we were talking, and finally we, you know, we're oblivious to what's all around us. And we said to him, what did you find in terms of the plane? And he bends over and he picks up this piece of metal that was a dime sized, quarter size. And he said, things like this. He said, anything that looks like it doesn't belong in the woods came from the plane. And I've never had this experience before or after, but it was like a camera shutter clicked with, when I blinked my eyes, it was like, and then debris was everywhere. Metal was everywhere. Wire was everywhere. Flight 93 was everywhere.
But you took on more of a role than just a journalist. I mean, you had a unique perspective as a journalist, but you got to know family members. You became friends with many of these people. These people trusted you. Wally Miller, you mentioned, became like their go-to person when they had a question about it. Tell me about that. How did you develop relationships with family members of the passengers?
It just was a matter of being there, I think. Right away, I have a great interest in history, and I was living in Gettysburg at the time. I saw the Park Service up close and personal, more good than bad, but I knew the road this was going down. And I had spent a lot of time on the battlefield, and I knew the Trossel Barn, Spangler Springs. Like, these were families' homes when the Battle of Gettysburg happened, and they walked out when the armies left, and they had this devastation on their property, and that crossed my mind. This was a moment that we had to go beyond whatever, you know, family obligations, journalistic obligations. Like, I had a higher being, I guess, to be part of this. I was a caretaker of this property now. That was part of the 9/11 story. So I would be at the site, family members would show up, and we'd just get to talking and walking the site. One of the family members, Sandy Bradshaw, was a flight attendant. She was the one who called her husband and said she was boiling water to throw in the terrorists. I met her. It was either her grandmother or her father's grandmother. And she looked at me and said, you're a journalist, huh? And I said, yeah. And she said, tell their story. And that's sort of been my guiding light whenever I get together with these families. And Wally brought me along to family-only meetings and different events that he trusted me to be part of, you know, his team in cleaning up the site and helping him kind of deal with everything that he had to deal with. Once the FBI left, it was his site. And he took a lot of that burden on, and the families just still to this day adore him for how he handled it. It was amazing.
Well, you have done a fabulous job over the years of telling their stories. But I have to say that the podcast that you produced with former WITF journalist, now NPR White House correspondent Scott Detrow, is the best 9/11 retrospective that I have ever heard. And we're going to hear a little bit of this. Just set it up a little bit. This is going to air on WITF tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, but you can go to the website WITF.org to listen to it. Just set up the piece that we're going to hear.
So the piece we're going to hear came the day, I think, the day after the actual memorial was dedicated. So it's 2011. And this was actually something I forgot about until we were talking about to family members about this. And there was a number of a good amount of unidentified remains that they didn't know what to do with. And the families decided they wanted to bury it at the site. And I had completely forgotten that I had visited the site the night before with Wally and a couple of his team members, and we watched them dig the graves. And I found these photos that I had that I forgot I took, and I contacted the Park Service about it, and they don't have anything like that on record. So we're going to have a conversation when everything dies down about how those photos can get into the Park Service's hands. But so the next day, after the memorial dedication, they had their own private burial. And this was something that was so important to the families because their grief was very public. They never had anything private. They were always in the public eye when it came to this site. And this was their chance where everything shut down, and the only people at this funeral, at this burial, were family members and friends.
Okay, let's give it a listen.
Ten years after 9/11, families, friends, and dignitaries were once again in Shanksville. This time, they were not just remembering those who died, but celebrating the memorial, which was finally rising on the site. Now, I could walk along a pathway past the crash site marked by that sandstone boulder. At the end of the pathway are 40 white marble slabs bearing the names of the passengers and crew. The ceremony that day had echoes of past anniversaries, the reading of the names, speeches about the heroics on board, and political leaders like former President George W. Bush.
We'll never know how many innocent people might have been lost. But we do know this. Americans are alive today because the passengers and crew of Flight 93 chose to act, and our nation will be forever grateful.
But it was something that happened 2 days after this event that sticks with me. The families returned to the memorial. This time, they were alone, except for some guests, people like me and Wally. They were here to do something they had long hoped to do, hold a funeral at the crash site. The unidentified remains had been placed in three caskets. Together, they would bury them near the sandstone boulder. Debbie was there.
We had all been waiting for that day. You don't know what it's like to come back anniversary after anniversary and put on a particular type of face as a family member, because who else is here with you is some dignitary, some politician, and not like there's nothing wrong with that. It's just never became something private and personal.
The remains were driven down by hearses.
We had pallbearers that brought the caskets out. We already had the plots dug out and ready for these caskets to be put in. All the family was down here. All of our invited guests were down here.
And then the caskets were lowered into the ground. A rabbi, a Buddhist priest, and a Lutheran minister jointly led the service. Patrick White was there, along with his cousin Kenny and other family members. They decided, spur of the moment, to honor a tradition from their own family.
After the caskets were put in place in the ground, brothers, cousin, whoever, took shovels and we buried our own.
Other people from other families picked up shovels and joined in.
And didn't stop until the job was finished.
And that's just a 3-minute segment of what you can hear of an hour-long program. And Tim, you know, I asked Colonel Ivanko about trying to keep your emotions in check. I mean, we as journalists are taught to do the same thing. Afterwards, it may come rushing back, like I remember did that day. But with having relationships with the family and so many people involved, I mean, this is it is sacred ground. It is a burial ground. It is a cemetery. How do you keep from getting emotional?
I don't. I am emotional. It was funny. We did several table reads. It's called when you read the scripts with an editor and the producer, and you kind of try to figure out what you want to edit out and how you want to shape the story. And there were at least four occasions where I couldn't get through a script reading where I had to stop. And it was always in different parts of the script where it would just break down. And they were very understanding of it because it is a very personal story for me. So, yeah, it just was something that it's impossible to do. And, you know, I'm prepared for Saturday at the memorial for the 20th anniversary of the families to bring a lot of tissues and handkerchiefs.
Are you going to be there?
I will be there, yeah. Lori Guadagno, who is part of the podcast, told her story about her brother Richard, who was a fish and wildlife officer. So, you know, Rich most likely was involved in taking back the cockpit. His credentials were actually found at or near my property intact, which was amazing. It's one of these amazing stories of these passengers. But she insisted that I sit with the family, and I certainly appreciate her doing that. So I will be there. Yeah.
Well, and Lori is she has a great story to tell. About her loss of her brother Richard, and again, I just can't say enough about it. Tim, thank you very much for all you've done over the past 20 years, but Sacred Ground in particular, you know, I've described it as destined to be a classic on WYTF because I just think it is that good in telling the story.
Thank you very much, and a lot of credit to Scott and the team at NPR that we worked with to really shape that story, and I appreciate everybody at WYTF who let me step away from Morning Edition for a couple of months and put aside my news director hat and work on something that means a lot to me. And I'm so proud of the result. And I hope that everybody who gets a chance to hear it learns something new and has a better understanding of what that site means to the people left behind.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WYTF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Today's Smart Talk Road Trip live from Moe Broadcast from the State Museum of Pennsylvania is supported by Fort Pitt Capital Group. Right after the 9/11 attacks, Americans came together to grieve, pray, and show their patriotism. There was a sense of togetherness, a feeling that we all were targets. Differences were put aside as we wept together. But that unique feeling only lasted so long. The further we got from 9/11, the more divided Americans became. 20 years after the attacks, we as a nation may be as divided as any time since the Civil War. What happened? Joining us is Gettysburg College Professor of History, Dr. Michael Berkner. Dr. Berkner, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me, Scott.
Let's go back to September 11th, 2001, and maybe more importantly, September 12th, 2001. Describe how what you saw across this nation.
Well, I saw a coming together as Americans, not any particular brand of American, but Americans. I saw people who were shocked and dismayed, people who were angry, people who were grieving, but people who also wanted to understand what the heck was happening. And I think above all, it was a sense that, you know, we had been attacked and we had to figure it out what was going to happen next. And we turned to our leaders and we also, we mourned together.
This was unique, but not totally unique. In American history, there are tragedies. There are incidents where Americans have come together. I think about the assassination of President Kennedy. Pearl Harbor may have been the best analogy that many people made to 9/11. Did the nation have that sense of unity during incidents like that?
Oh, absolutely. And the analogy with Pearl Harbor is very strong. You know, it was an attack on our homeland. It was a surprise. We had been complacent beforehand about the potential for something like this. When it did happen, and 2,400 Americans died at Pearl Harbor, more than 2,700 in the attack at 9/11. I think that there were remarkable similarities in the way the country responded to this. And I think that it brought out the best in many ways in terms of who we are as a people. Unfortunately, the circumstances post 9/11 took a very different turn than the circumstances after Pearl Harbor, where we had a war that we were going to wage on two fronts, and where people did actually pull together for the long haul. That didn't happen for a variety of reasons in the wake of 9/11, as you have just alluded.
Well, it's a simple question. What happened?
Well, a lot happened. There were many paths to the place we are now in a kind of tribalistic America. And you can't just say it was shock jocks on radio. You can't just say it was inequality. You can't just say it was the Iraq War. It was all of those things and more. I think one of the underlying factors here that tends to get missed is that over the past 20 years or more, Americans have tended to choose to live where people think the way that they do. We actually self-segregate as we never had in our history. And as a consequence, we have this divide, which tends to be very urban, cosmopolitan versus more rural, traditional. And that divide certainly came out in the elections for the presidency in 2016 and 2020. And so in a way, we're self-selecting who we want to listen to, what we want to believe, and how we want to react to specific events. And I think that that's not a very healthy environment that we're in, but I think it's an environment that doesn't always have to be that way.
One of the big differences between 1941 and 2001 and beyond is the technology, social media. I mean, you were just referring to listening and reading and watching the kind of news that just reaffirms our point of view. But what about the internet and social media, all those things, and the role that has played in dividing Americans?
Yeah, sure. We people who are on one side of a political perspective tend to go to a particular media, whether it's, you know, on the internet or whether it's a television cable show. That is something that is new, Scott, for sure. There aren't that many smart talks out there, but there sure are a lot of places where you can hear exactly what you want to hear and feel like you're rooting for your team and against the other team, except that it's played out at a very severe level because we don't even agree on whether we should wear masks or get vaccinated. And that seems to be, I think, a symptom of the malaise that we have now in our country this way.
I think you're saying it, you know, talking about it perfectly. It was the 2020 election, a pandemic like we haven't seen in 100 years, social media. There's just so much going on right now that Americans, it seems like we can't deal with it all, and that we take bits and pieces of what we want to see and hear and read and solidify our own beliefs. And that goes back to what you were talking about earlier. This division, it's not just one thing.
It is not. So how do we get out of it?
That's right.
That seems to me. And by the way, if I knew the answer to that question, which you're suggesting, you know, I would be paid a lot of money by a lot of people who make big decisions in this country. But I'll say something about this because, I teach college and, you know, the kids that I teach come from different backgrounds, have different ideological perspectives on the world. And we talk in my case history, but we also talk about other things. And there's the word, Scott, your program, Smart Talk. We have to talk to each other. Let's just think about this. You have a neighbor who has a very different political view than you, but you know the neighbor's a good person, and if you were in trouble, that neighbor would help you just as you would help him or her. So the question becomes, can you actually just say, why do you think the way you do? And this is how I think the way I do, and find out that there are actually underneath the tribalistic perspectives, there are actually some commonalities we can work toward.
We only have about 30 seconds left. Are you optimistic that will happen?
I'm mixed. I think it can happen. I think you see it happening if you look at the local government level, particularly little communities like the one I live in, Gettysburg, where people are ordinarily or formerly Republicans and Democrats, but they're not talking about politics and ideology. They're trying to get the job done. And I think that local people doing things of outreach to each other is really the best hope we could have.
Gettysburg College Professor of History, Dr. Michael Berkner. Dr. Berkner, thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Scott.
We've been broadcasting from the State Museum of Pennsylvania, Smart Talk Road Trip. Thank you for being with us. Thank our audience for being with us today. Have yourself a great day.